Hello, 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 and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohegan people, who are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. I've been away for a while, had to go get some education and take some tests, but I'm back.
Good to have you back. Today,
thank you.
Oh, and I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. And today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley. It's a report on the Albany County Executive Climate Resiliency Plan. Then for this week's labor segment, Wheelie Terry brings us part of the conversation that took place after the screening of Till as part of Black History Month. Later on, Triple E's is back. And this week, H. Bosch Jr. is interviewing Andrea the Chocolate Butterfly Williams about her business, BU Butterfly. After that, we hear from a mother who is impacted by the work from Dr. David Carpenter, the professor who will be celebrated this Sunday at the Sanctuary for Independent Media and awarded with the Good Trouble Award. Finally, we interview Susan Brink, who's returning live Jazz Sanctuary programming to Sanctuary Radio from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. weekdays, starting right after this program. But first, here are the headlines.
That is great that Jazz is coming back, and welcome back, Susan. First, some headlines. New York State will lower minimum scores for the student proficiency in math, English, saying that the low scores last year are the new normal. The scores are used to measure schools' overall performance. Last year, some schools posted shocking results. In Schenectady, no eighth graders who took the math test scored as proficient, and the scores for the third through eighth grade tests throughout the state were much lower in 2022 than in 2019.
State lawmakers believe that Governor Hochul's proposal to index the state minimum wage of inflation does not go far enough. They are seeking larger increases. Some lawmakers are proposing that the upstate minimum wage be raised to $20 an hour by 2026.
Good. Charlotte Bennett, a one-time aide to former Governor Cuomo, who sued him for sexual harassment, has filed a separate lawsuit Wednesday against the state when Bennett reported the harassment. Top aides to the governor transferred her to a lesser job in health policy instead of taking appropriate measures. She said she eventually resigned.
In a decision with important statewide climate implications, the New York State Public Service Commission has rejected National Grid's plan to charge its customers to build a new fossil gas vaporizers in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. The state determined that the expansion is not needed for energy reliability and directed the gas utility to work on energy efficiency instead of increasing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's it for the headlines.
Okay. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital regions through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Okay, the Albany County Executive Office is developing a climate resiliency plan for Albany County to address risks and vulnerabilities associated with an increase in frequency and severity of storm events, sea level rise, flooding, and other climate-related hazards. Lucas Rogers, the Economic Development and Sustainability Coordinator for the County Executive, discusses the plan with Mark Dunley.
Today we are going to cover the Albany County Climate Resiliency Plan, and we are talking with Lucas Rogers, who is the Economic Development and Sustainability Coordinator in the Office of the Albany County Executive, as well as Liz King, who is a consultant with Bergman, who assisted in development of the plan. So Lucas, maybe you could start off explaining, you know, why is Albany County developing a climate resiliency plan? And, you know, where's the plan at the moment?
Thanks, Mark. That's a great starting point, because this really was a first of its kind initiative for the county. We had lots of previous sustainability initiatives, but this was our first foray into a climate resiliency plan. We were earlier in 2019 awarded funding by New York State Department of State to complete this initiative. And really what it's all about is being proactive. That's the reason we took this plan on. We in the county have a lot of strengths from a climate perspective and a lot of strength from a sustainability perspective, but we wanted to build on those strengths. And so what this plan does, it starts by coming up with sort of a vision of what does resiliency mean to Albany County. And that was created in partnership with a myriad of stakeholders. So we engaged what we called a technical advisory committee of local partners who have expertise in these fields, as well as a municipal committee with representatives from each of the towns, cities, and villages in the county, and several other stakeholder public meetings, et cetera, to craft that vision. And then from there, it followed a process of identify the assets in the county that are key to the way we live and work, assess the climate risk to those assets, and that those fall into different categories, but our housing, our hospitals, our educational institutions, our airport, things of that nature, assess the risk, and then identify policies, projects, and programs that the county can lead or partner with local organizations on in order to address those risks. So that's really the, to oversimplify a very complicated plan, that's the process that we followed. And to your question about where we are today, we're in the final phase of receiving comments on the plan and hope to have a final report out in the coming month or so.
So this is a resiliency plan, which, as you mentioned, you know, basically address the risk and vulnerabilities associated with basically climate change, sea level rise, flood, and other climate hazards. How would you distinguish that or relate that to sort of climate mitigation and adaptation? And, you know, do you plan to, I don't know, maybe address those related issues separately in a separate report later on?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I think that we made an effort to highlight many of the county's mitigation efforts. And just to make that distinction, and many know, but some may not, you know, mitigation is all the actions we're taking to prevent climate change. And that's procuring renewable energy, promoting electrification of vehicles, things along those lines. And we made an effort to highlight many of those actions in the plan, but we also wanted to be cognizant of avoiding sort of mission creep or plan creep, where if we tried to tackle everything related to climate change in this plan, we would really devalue what the plan was intended to be, which is focused on mitigation and resilience, or rather adaptation and especially resilience, which is how do we respond? How do we prepare is adaptation, but then how do we respond and making sure our infrastructure is hardened on the one hand, but there's non-infrastructure items in this plan about, you know, making sure we have the right networks in place to build back after an event. And that obviously ties to resiliency. And making sure that our assets are proactively protected, but that, you know, you can have things like temporary housing for in the event of a major disaster, or resources for businesses on how to respond to a major disaster. And, you know, we obviously over the last 3 years just went through with the COVID-19 pandemic, not a climate disaster, but a disaster that severely impacted. And we take a lot of lessons from that. And just finally to your question on how will or do we plan to address the mitigation side of things? We are fortunate to be kicking off a greenhouse gas inventory in the coming weeks. And the plan is to follow that with what you'd call a climate action plan. And that looks more at those items, looks more holistically at the county and the community to say, what steps are we taking to reduce emissions in the county?
Now, one thing you mentioned was the issue of how do you build back after so an extreme weather event? And I happen to live along the Postonkill Creek over in Rensselaer County. But sort of, a lot of flooding and damage, particularly after Hurricane Irene a number of years ago. Does the plan anticipate making any type of suggestions to municipalities about, maybe taking a step back as these floodplains begin to expand during climate change and maybe not allowing people to build back in areas that are likely to be flooded in the future?
It does have some recommendations to look at how we build in the future. And that starts with data. There's plenty of anecdotal information, which is important. But one of the things we looked at in the plan is making sure that our communities and our residents had access to builders and developers had access to the best data about the areas of the county that are prone to not just current flood risk, but future flood risk. And we have data sets that anticipate out in 2050 and beyond. So that's one part of your question. The other part that we talk about in the plan is partnering with municipalities on a few areas where they can be proactive around the way they look at their internal policies and programs. One is participation in what's called a CRS program. And what that does, it's called the Community Rating System from FEMA. And it basically gives each municipality the tools they need to evaluate planning and zoning policies and things of that nature to make that kind of informed decision. And we had funding in the plan to work with one community to pursue that CRS rating. And the benefit of that rating is if you're successful, you actually have the opportunity to reduce flood insurance bills for your residents. So there's a real incentive. It's not just do it because it's the right thing to do. It's a real incentive to pursue that. We are working with Green Island as part of that plan. But as part of that effort, we're creating basically a template for other communities to be able to mimic and to work on into the future.
So we only have about 30 seconds left. So it's a two-part question. Any major strategies you saw arising out of this? And if people want to get more information about the plan, how best to do that?
The easiest way, there's a URL. It's go to the county website, and there's a section on the climate resiliency plan. Frankly, Googling Albany County Climate Resiliency Plan is the fastest way you're going to get there. As far as overarching strategies, there are many, but all of these plans focus on collaboration. The county may be lead on many of them, but whether it's looking at a resilient homes program, looking at a Green Streets initiative, or sort of a climate core of volunteers, all of these require partnerships. And the biggest takeaway, if I could, is we don't, and the county executive does not want this to be a plan that sits on a shelf. We are looking to really take a few of these recommendations in the plan and act on them quickly
We're out of time, unfortunately. We've been talking with Lucas Roger and Liz King, Albany County Climate Resiliency Plan, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Mark Dunley is our climate correspondent. You can find more climate coverage on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
A couple of weeks back in February, in Black History Month, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended a screening of the movie Till at the Art Center of the Capital Region. The screening was followed by a discussion which included panelists, Shauna Davis, president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unions, and Renee Powell, president of the Troy NAACP. Here's a take from that interview.
If I could start, I'd like to share a little bit about this Emmett Till story is close to my heart, near and dear, personal. My mom would talk about Emmett Till very much so in our growing up. She was 13 years old when Emmett Till was killed. And so she would share that story with us often about Emmett Till and how it impacted her and impacted her life. So much so, you know, when it came time to attend the March on Washington in 1963, she actually was pregnant with me and attended that march. And I always hold that like so near and dear to me because she would always make sure that I knew that that was extremely important to her. But the ironic thing, the irony is in 1991, my brother, Corey Sheldon, was killed in Albany. He was a veteran. He was employed at Albany Medical Center. He was 21 years old. And on January 3rd, he was picked up by the Albany police. And he was strangled. And they accused him 3 weeks after that of being in Washington Park. And they found a pinky print on the car of someone who had been assaulted in the Price Chopper on Delaware Avenue weeks prior. But my brother was killed. To watch this movie is very traumatizing because the cry that this mother cried was the cry that my mom cried that night. And to watch the steps of what this woman went through, how this death of Emmett Till impacted my mom, and to not only after that, she would actually experience something so similar to the point where she fought, just like this mom fought, right? The Albany NAACP was involved for some time and actually helped us hire a second pathologist so that we would have our own autopsy, because the autopsy that they had given us said that he had taken his own life. But when they had hired this pathologist from New Jersey who came and did the autopsy, made it clear that there was no way that this 260-pound, 21-year-old man could kill himself with his army jacket, that he had been dead prior to that. When we went to Albany Med that morning, it was clear that he had been gone some hours. When we got there, they had him under heat lamps to try to warm his body. And I only say that because when I watched the people in the courtroom and the things that they said in the courtroom, how the power that these people had to do the things that they did and how they bring other people in to support their story, to get away with whatever they did, we experienced that to some degree. So when we continue to see, then there wasn't no cameras on your phone for people to videotape. So years and years later, when we continue to see things and behaviors like this, it's hurtful. I can't say that we haven't had some successes, because thank God for cameras, because people can't hide the things that they are doing. But the trauma still lives in us. So now, in 1991, we had white people supporting us, where in 1955, Emmett Till's mom didn't. Right. So in 1991, white people and black people stood with us when we marched at the mayor's house, when we marched at Division II looking for answers. But I can't take up all night to tell you the steps that we went through and the things that were hidden and the lies that were told and the people that were moved to cover up the story and then make my brother shamed because of a choice that people made. Emmett Till told the woman she looked like a movie star.
Right.
And all of a sudden, her hands were behind her back.
Right.
Pulled to the right, to the left,
right.
You know? But that's how far they have to go to cover up the ills that happen. But the trauma that lives in us because of that, living in fear, we don't want our kids to live in fear, right? So she's a mother of a son. My mother was a mother, and I say was, I lost my mom last year. My mom was a mother of sons, right? And I'm a mother of a son. But we don't want our children to live in fear. So we teach our children the stories of the past, but in teaching them the stories of the past, how do we not allow them to live in the trauma of fear? And that's us building relationships and continuing, we can continue to tell the story, but we have to continue to build a relationship so that when we tell the story, that our children know when the fear is, when it happens, who they can talk to, who they can depend on, and where they can go. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Oh, thank you.
Well, this is my second time seeing the movie. And the first time, I didn't pick up a lot of things that I saw this time. And you know, a couple of things that I was impressed with in this movie is that there was a opportunity to see the lifestyle of Black people back in the 50s. It wasn't all a situation of poverty.
Right.
We may not have been the richest, but we had a decent life.
Yes.
And that was demonstrated in the movie. That, and it showed the contrast of how folks in the South were living versus those who moved to the North for a better way of life. I really picked up on that this time in the movie. The other thing that I picked up on and I was saddened by it is that the mother, in giving Emmett Till the talk, son, you gave him a talk.
Right.
I've given my sons the talk.
Yes.
She gave her son the set of Negro rules that you don't do anything. Here we are, even into this day, we still have to give the talk to our son.
To the girls too,
that's right. It's just sad that we still have to have that kind of talk. We still, you know, we talk to kids no matter what their race and class are. You know, there's certain things you don't do, like drinking and driving and going out here and acting up and destroying property. But we have to have that additional talk about if you get pulled over, put your hands up on the steering wheel, you know, that whole thing. And we're still doing that today. Hopefully one day we will get to a point where we don't have to worry about that or have that kind of talk. The other thing, I remember a friend, I worked for the federal government, worked for the Department of Agriculture, and she had an opportunity to retire early. And she said, I'm going to move to North Carolina. I said, oh, that's good. She said, no, I'll get a job down there. I said, okay. Now, in D.C., when we go to work, we dress. She went to North Carolina and she dressed. That was not the thing to do. That was a big no-no, yes. She did not keep her job. And when she talked to Emmett Till, the mom talked to him about wearing the ring down there, that immediately came back to me. You know, you even have to be careful, you know, how you present yourself in different situations.
Yes.
You can't really be yourself.
Right, yes.
The other thing in this movie, and I wasn't exactly sure, I knew it was recent, but it, and the amount of time, it took 67 years to make lynching a federal crime.
Yes.
You have all kinds of different types of killing that have been a federal crime, except for lynching, and now we have that as a federal crime. Yeah. So just watching this movie, I'll probably have to watch it a third time. I'll probably pick up some more things.
Yes.
But that first time that I saw it, it was very sad, traumatic, and it just put me back to with my sons.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the young people here. I had to get my hats off to them. They stayed, watched the whole movie, and they were very attentive, and even got a little interactive. I felt like I was back home in the theater.
So That was part one of Willie Terry's coverage of the discussion following the screening of Till with Coalition of Black Train Unionists and Troy NAACP.
For those, and great interview. Again, Mr. Terry, you knocked it out of the box. So for those of you listening, you're tuning in. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Bosch, could you take the rest of it?
Yes, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio on WOOCLP 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, WOOGLP 92.7 FM, Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM, Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online, mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. So if you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend, find today's story and more at mediasanctuary.org. All right. Ready for our third segment. What a guest. Our next guest on the Triple E's segment, and welcome back with the Triple E's segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship, is the Reverend Dr. Andrea Williams, speaker, world-renowned author, and president and CEO of My Butterfly, which we will talk about more in the interview.
Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, great. Thank you so much for taking time out your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, listen, we got a lot to unpack, so I'm going to dig right in then. Why did you name your company Butterfly?
So it's BU Butterfly, Unique Butterfly.
Okay, BU Butterfly.
And I named it that. Right. BU Butterfly. Okay. And it's a message, because a lot of times we try to assimilate and mimic other people and we don't realize that God meant us to be unique from the start. So that's why our company is called BU Butterfly.
Wow. Isn't that something? How unique. So how do you personify the BU Butterfly mantra?
Interesting that you asked me that. I personify it by calling myself the chocolate butterfly. The first time someone called me that, she was of a lighter hue, African-American woman, but she was a lighter hue. And I was like, why does she call me the chocolate butterfly? And I scrunched my face up when I got home and I was mad and I was stumping around my little apartment. And God was like, you are chocolate, right? You are a proud African-American woman, right? And you're full of color and depth. That's why she called you the chocolate butterfly. And I've been the chocolate butterfly ever since.
And you wear it. Let me lean in like you did. You wear it very well. So
thank you. It took a lot to get this together. We don't wake up like this.
Okay. I'll let you say that.
I'm noticing just how lovely you look.
Yes.
You're glistening.
Yes. Awesome. I mean, you know, I always say you look marvelous, absolutely marvelous. So what is the Get You Booked program? Can you speak to that a little bit?
So it's Get BU Booked. Mm-hmm. So it's Get BU Booked. And you can follow us on Facebook as Get BU Booked. And it's BU Booked, like BU Booked from the start, from page number one. You can be BU Booked on your life, on our books, on your dreams, on your passion, and your goals.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting. So what is the biggest challenge you've overcome as an entrepreneur? You know, because I know there's so many obstacles that are just self-imposed and then unseen challenges. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Comparing myself to other people. Wow. Comparing my successes to other people, comparing how I'm received to other people, not even taking one of my coaches gave me my own words back, which delivered me from evil, and I had to say, oh, you're right. Because she was like, why are you looking at what everybody else is doing? You preach every day about being unique. You preach every day about forging your own path. You preach every day about doing things even when other people don't agree with you. And that goes back to what BU Butterfly is. It's BU Butterfly. Now, I'm not saying you're going to go from a caterpillar to a butterfly without some work. So you have to first have that dream. Then after you have the dream, you have to believe in that dream. Mm,
yes,
and after you believe in that dream, because that dream, your belief is going to pull you through. Then you have to pursue it. You can't just sit on it. You have to pursue it. And you have to be diligent about pursuing it. And then you can achieve it. And until I followed my own mantra, I was having all kinds of pitfalls. Once I decided, no matter what happens, no matter what comes my way, I'm going to take every step and congratulate myself.
Great.
And that was my overcome.
So we have a few more that I want to get through, a few more questions. How many books have you written and what is your goal?
So I have written six, three of which is published. One is at the editor. I had a meeting today. I'm very excited about that next project. And our goal, our ultimate goal is to reduce the 76% of our youth. It says 76% of our youth are living with depression. That's our goal. Our goal is not to sell a million books. Our goal is to change a million lives. So if people buy a million books and their lives are changed, then I've met my goal. But if I can just reach that one person, that one young person who feels like they have nowhere in this world and nobody understands them, then I've reached my goal.
Great, great. You recently gave a keynote speech entitled The Game of Life. Tell me about it a little bit.
The Game of Life. So you know how everybody's always saying life is not a game. Then they tell you there's rules to life. Then they tell you there's key players in life. And then they tell you you have to be smart and maneuver through all of these different ups and downs and take it like a champ. But life is not a game. They're lying to us. Life is a game. You have to know the key players. You have to know the rules, and you know have to know how to maneuver around the pitfalls so that you don't get your lives taken.
I agree. So what advice would you give someone who wants to write a children's book, you know, that, you know, don't have a clue about how to start?
Remember that you're talking, that children are looking for your honesty. So if you're not ready to be honest, don't write a children's book. Write a fiction book, write something else. You might be gifted at writing, but don't write a children's book. That's number one. Number two, write it. Just write it. I think sometimes we sit in our head and we wait till somebody tells us, and I did this for 48 years. I sat there waiting on somebody to tell me it was okay for me to pursue my dreams. Well, all along, all I had to do was do it. So maybe you just need to get it on paper. Put it, write it down.
Right.
Write it down right. And see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And see if you like it.
Great. I want to close out with two more questions, but I see Mom in the background. So let me just say, hi, Mom. You know, I got to give you a shout
She's
out. You know?
Mama Butterfly is always around.
Right, right. And apples don't fall far from the tree. You have raised a fantastic daughter. You also have founded the Queen Boss Circle. I like that. Talk to me a little bit about that. And we have one more question.
The Queen Boss Circle is very awesome. Queen Boss Circle is an upcoming event where we're inviting other women in, me and a few of my favorite local entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs, in the honor of Women's Month. We're doing a Queen Boss Circle vision party where we're going to be sharing our tricks and tips and what we do and what we've learned as female entrepreneurs so we can help others pursue their dreams. We call it the Imagine, Inspire, and Ignite Fest.
Wow. So I'm going to close out with this, Pastor Williams. Finally, what are some of the personal or professional goals that you hope to achieve in the next few years? All right. You got 20 seconds.
So my personal goal is to get on film with my books. That's my personal goal. I want to be able to talk nationally. Number two, I want to be able to impact more lives in more cities. So if you're looking for someone like the Chocolate Butterfly to come inspire your children in the areas of science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, or you want them to see themselves in a positive light, I'm your girl. Diversity and STEAM-based speaker, here I come.
Wow. That's the way to close it out. Reverend Doctor, all right. I'm going to say that again. I'm putting that on your name. Reverend Dr. Andrea Williams, thank you so much. It has been a plum pleasing pleasure to have you as a guest on the Triple E show. You are now part of the family, so welcome.
Thank you.
We plan on having you back soon, and God bless you. May heaven continue to smile upon you and continue to let your light shine.
Thank you. And if you want to get our books, just go to www.beubutterfly.com.
Thank you so much. All right. We'll see you soon. Okay.
Next up, David Carpenter's work in environmental advocacy has benefited a lot of people. Ahead of Sunday's event, to honor his work, a mother whose child was having problems with environmental issues, health issues, reached out to praise Dr. Carpenter through email. So we wanted to hear more. This Sunday, March 19th, at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, Dr. David Carpenter will be celebrated for his long career as an environmental advocate and will be given the 2023 Good Trouble Award. Joining me now is one of the many people who have been impacted by the work of Dr. David Carpenter, Andrea Mercier. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi.
So, Hi. For listeners who may not know Dr. David Carpenter, how would you describe him in a succinct way?
Dr. Carpenter is versed in environmental impact and public health in more than one way, surprisingly. And so, I guess I hadn't really known of him much until I was trying to figure out what was going on with our son.
What should listeners know about who you are?
Yeah, I'm a mother. I really care about special needs children. I also have experience taking care of medically fragile people for years. Over 20 years, and I've gone and lived in different states and different areas with environmental problems and have seen, I guess, some of the impacts that are just not really acknowledged in our world. So it was very difficult for me to go from state to state and see things going on and then having things going on with my own child and trying to put all the pieces together. And so I kind of stopped working in the field, and then I decided, you know what, I'm going to open up a childcare, and I'm going to take care of kids with special needs, and I learned a lot from them as well. And so then I was having a hard time because I needed help. I needed people to come and work with me, and I needed to expand. But I also needed to have some time to get some therapies for our son. And so I went on a journey and went into all the different therapy fields and learned about all the different types of therapy that are available. And I just knew there was this missing piece of environment. And so environment was this missing piece of a puzzle and how it impacted everything. And so I started to look at all of these different environmental pieces to the puzzle. Water was probably the first one, then the air we breathe, and then I looked at electromagnetism, and then after that I started looking at geopathic stress, solar cycles, and I went into physics and started reading about that and studying a lot of papers. Our son was in school, and I was kind of cleaning up our environment at home because I started to notice patterns, and I was kind of cleaning up our electromagnetic environment to see if there were any improvements over the summer when he wasn't in school. And I noticed improvements in his health, cleaning up his environmental exposures overall. And that is something known as total load theory.
You said in your email that David Carpenter is one of the scientists who's partially responsible for what you came to understand about your child. Could you explain how you discovered his work and what it was that he helped you and your family to understand?
When it came to the wireless problem, David sort of said, you know, your son is on the severe end of the exposure, you know, spectrum, and here's a couple research articles, and then you can make a decision for yourself, right? He's not saying I have all the answers. He's saying here's something to analyze and to understand. And then I just took it from there. You know, I really went further after that because that's just the nature of who I am. So no matter what scientist it is that I'm involved in, I just kind of take it a little further because I want to contribute to helping solve the problems that we currently face in our world.
Dr. Carpenter has been testifying against Monsanto about the dangers of weed killers and their harm on people and animals. So how did you see where you were living in Minnesota and having that environmental impact that you say was missing on the care aspect of your child?
Yeah. So, I mean, I really saw it in more than one way. I saw it in the farmers. There were farming communities that had a high incidence of neurodegenerative diseases in these communities and cancer. And then when I would drive to those areas, it was hard for me because I would see dead animals in the farm fields. And I can't say that a dead animal equals an exposure, right? But it was just, it was alarming, and I think that was part of it. And then in terms of our son, one of the most concerning things for me was I could have swore, you know, I was looking at liver effects on the liver, and I didn't know how to ask the physicians, you know, hey, can we look at this? And still to this day, this is not something that is that we're doing. We're not, when we diagnose people, we're not looking for exposures. And so it seemed to me like there was something going on with his liver function that was altering his ability to function overall. So nobody really wanted to look at that. And he was in a school where they were spraying the fields in Minnesota and in the Midwest. A lot of the air that you breathe is humid. There's lake effect. The humidity comes from the really dark black soil, and then the sun beating down on that dark black soil. And so whatever's emanating from the spraying is coming up, and not only are you possibly drinking it in your water supply, but you're breathing it in. I found that the state knows that there's all of these degradates in our water supply all throughout our state. What are you guys doing in terms of cleaning that up? And they were just really hyper-focused on lead, which is great. But I really think that we need to expand outside of lead and figure out what to do about this stuff. And then I would go out to organic farmers and ask them, what do you guys know? What can you teach me about this problem with our water? And they said, well, you know, with Roundup, it takes like 10 years for the soil to kind of fully break down the contaminant from Roundup. And I said, oh, okay. I said, but what about all of these other pesticides being used, you know, like I'm trying to think of it, 2,4-D, dicamba, and then, of course, the nitrate problem with the fertilizers that are running off into the lakes. and causing, you know, toxic algae blooms. So I'm trying to ask them what they're doing about it, and nobody really had an answer. Then I think we had our governor at the time, I'm blanking on his name. One of his solutions was to build sort of like soil barriers to prevent things from getting into the water supply. But I don't really think that fully addresses the issue because, like I said, there's a humidity component to this, and then there's a stormwater component to this. And you have these people in communities applying these things to their lawns, and then it's all running off everywhere.
So we're celebrating him with the 2023 Good Trouble Award. Why do you think Dr. David Carpenter is a good candidate for this award?
Because he's not afraid to say things. He's not afraid to do something and do the right thing. He really isn't. And he's not afraid to kind of like slightly say, look, this is something we haven't looked at closely. You know, this is something we need to understand. This is something we need to clean up. He really is an advocate for human health, animal health, environmental health. So he deserves this award.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea Mercier, for telling us about you and your family and how Dr. David Carpenter helped you to understand health issues. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
The event, David Carpenter, Science for the People, takes place this Sunday, March 19th, from 2 to 5 p.m. to celebrate the work of Dr. Carpenter with featured speakers, soup, networking, and more. You can find more at mediasanctuary.org.
Great, great interview, Sina. As of Thursday, March 16th, Jazz Sanctuary returns. Wow. Yay. As live programming to the Sanctuary Radio, we are now joined by DJ Susan Brink, the organizer behind Jazz Sanctuary. Welcome back to the studio, Susan.
Hey, Bob.
How's your volume?
My volume is wonderful. How are you?
Good. How you doing? Welcome back.
Oh, it's Man. Good to be home.
Yes. I guess it would be accurate to say, haven't seen you in a couple of years.
Yeah. Time flies.
Yes. Yes. Well, we
That's
are
right.
so
So you
glad.
Know each other quite well because you would transition on Thursdays in the studio.
Yes. Right. And me and Susan were one of the originals that started all of this stuff off. Right, Susan?
We certainly you know? Did.
Yeah, way back when we all met and we had just this dream and vision, and look what it's turned out to be. So how you doing? How's everything? How's the family? Everybody good?
Everybody's good. Everyone's excited to be returning to Jazz Sanctuary.
Yeah, you don't know how much I miss that. Wow, I am so looking forward to it. So, Sina, I'm going to hand it off to you and let you start it off.
Well, thanks. And you were talking about the origins. When did Jazz Sanctuary begin? What was it like at that time?
Well, Steve had approached me a few years before we came on the air and said he would love to see jazz in radio format here. And there was no studio at the time. And he said, I don't have the time. Would you run it? Would you put it together? Would you run it? And I said, oh, that's an awful lot of work. I'll get back to you. And we went back and forth with it for a while, and then I decided I would do that. He didn't know I was a broadcast major in college, and I thought it would be nice to come back and do that at this point. We had decided that we didn't want the music siloed. We didn't want it to be swing on Monday, vocalists of the 40s on Tuesday. We wanted to mix up the music because there's 100 years of jazz, mm-hmm. 100 years of this music, and it needs to be heard. So that's how we ran it. When you listen to Jazz Sanctuary, you're going to hear something from the last 100 years, from new artists to legacy artists. And if you aren't thrilled with what you're hearing, give us another 10 minutes, and you'll hear something totally different.
And you just gave a little preview on just the scope of this genre. What is the importance of this genre and its revolutionary importance?
It's American music. It's American classic, Black American classical music. There's a lot of names for it, but it's American homegrown. It's not European. It comes from the African American community and bubbled up in, like, the blues, like hip hop. There's all different kinds of music that become adjacent to and support it. But that's where it started. And there are people who don't like the word jazz. They do use the word Black American music, or spontaneous composition.
Yeah, I have a question as, like, I am still working on my jazz vocabulary. And to my understanding, jazz also had a very much of, like, the structure, the breakup of the structure, challenged people's perceptions of a flow of music. Is there something like that? Is like, it wasn't just the roots of Black American music, but it was also a like expression. It was like speaking through instruments, which challenged many people's perception of music.
Well, exactly. There's so many different rooms in the jazz house. There's so many rooms. But yes, jazz is about freedom and it's about expression completely. And there are many artists that do that.
And how important is this program in this area? Jazz Sanctuary, how unique is Jazz Sanctuary? And are there any comparable jazz programs in the Capital Region and beyond?
Jazz is very popular in the Capital Region, and we have a very strong, supportive jazz community, but there is nowhere that there's a daily program. There is,
absolutely.
You know, there's a couple of hours here. You know, you got Bill McCann doing Saturday mornings. You have Tim Coakley doing Saturday night. But there's no consistent where you can turn on the radio or live stream and hear jazz in all its glory and all its variety.
Susan, that's where I want to chime in and say, one is I regret that more people don't know about this, because when I mention this to them, they're like, really, where's that at? And when does it come on? And we were on, and I think it was five nights a week from 7 to 10. And two, I think that this segment that you do and the other DJs do has the potential to really have a broad impact on the entire Capital Region and more, because there is no program like that that plays jazz. You know, there's programs that are here and there, people cherry pick it, you know, this program, that program, but on a consistent basis. So I want to close out with this question. Do you feel also, along with playing great, great jazz music, are you re-educating folks to jazz? Because most people don't know about the true history of jazz. Would you consider yourself an educator as well as a DJ?
Absolutely. But it's not that dry and it's not that cut and dry. This was also dance music. It was the popular music of the day at one time. And there are rooms where that still exists, where one of the best compliments I got was parents were cleaning up after supper and dancing to the radio.
Yes.
And I just love that. I just love that. So yes, I think people can be educated, but I also think they're going to be entertained. And I think they're going to have a chance to dream and to think, you know, it's all about expression. It's all about freedom. It's a sanctuary.
Now, are we bringing back the same lineup of jazz DJs, or are we bringing back anybody new? And what's, we both are a mutual friend of him. What's his name? He filled in some days for you. Oh, my goodness. What is his name? I'm drawing a blank, Susan.
I don't know, but what we do, March 28th, we're going to start. Well, I'll be on Mondays and Thursdays. On Tuesdays, we have Michael Benedict, who's a local musician and educator. He plays drums and vibe. And on Wednesdays, we're going to have Tariq Shah, who's a bass player, well known. And on Friday, we've got Sonny Mac coming back.
There you go. That's our guy. Sonny Mac, right.
We got our Sonny Mac.
Yes, Sonny Mac. Yes. Oh, man. He's my guy. Yeah, I love Sonny. He's a great guy. Yeah. You know.
And we have 1 minute left, and I'd love to just know what sustains you, what keeps you, continues to keep you dedicated to this program?
My love of the music and my love of radio. I have a complete and total belief in radio and in jazz. You got to keep it moving. You got to keep the tradition going forward. And the best way to expose people to it is to do it.
Well said. Say that again. Yes.
So Jazz Sanctuary will be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Is that right?
Yep. 7 to 10 weeknights.
Great.
Here on WOOC.
Thank you so much, Susan Brink. It's been a pleasure to get to know you, as I didn't know you previously to this week, and to be hearing more jazz. And with that, that was our show.
Right.
Bosch, and again, it was great to have you back.
Yes, thank you. It's always glad to be back. And Susan, it is always a pleasure seeing you, and so glad you're back and looking forward to some great, great jazz music.
So that's Bosch, H. Bosch Jr. Okay. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, also your engineer. We want to thank the rest of the volunteers who made this show possible. That's Mark Dunley, Willie Terry, and Susan Brink. And this program covers stories of social and environmental justice, produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary Sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
Great. We want to hear from you. You'll find us at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, mediasanctuary.org, or send us an email at hmm. All right. MediaSanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at the website in your favorite podcast. We appreciate you listening. Until next time, I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. and
Sina Bazila Hickey.
There you go.
It's Nico, the youngest producer. You've been listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, featuring news and views from around the New York Capital Region. Listen at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. on Sanctuary Radio, 105.3 FM, Troy, and online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also visit mediasanctuary.org anytime to hear the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on demand or to sign up for our podcast.